but what it is. All right, welcome everybody. We'll continue with Ruth, Seth, and data security. So I'll hand it over to our speakers. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, it's very nice to be at FOSDEM. It's a first for me, so I'm glad to have made it here. We work for IBM, but as you can hear from my voice, I had a little bit of a tough time traveling. So instead of wearing my corporate circular 223.7 compliant blue shirt, you get my academic look instead, which for those of you that are local gives you a great joke, because it took me as a Harvard graduate 10 minutes to find the stairs to this floor. So anyway, jet lag. Let's call it jet lag. So my marketing manager taught me an important lesson years ago, which is it's malpractice not to introduce yourself. So the short version is, I had the privilege of spending my entire career in open source, or nearly so. Spent the last 10 years working on Ceph. Before that, I was the product person for Ubuntu Server. And before that, I was the very much feared systems management czar at SUSE. A bunch of other things that I worked on. Was the maintainer of Man for about 10 years. Picture there with the clouds is because I wrote a book on AWS, stuff like that. I think that's enough on me. There we go.
Hi, everyone. I'm Sage McTaggart, and I use they, them pronouns. I'm also at IBM and working on cybersecurity. I come from a decision to leave academia and work at Red Hat, and then we moved to IBM. And in terms of that side of my background, I've done everything from theoretical computer science, focusing on things like formal language theory, oblivious computation, to just plain storage system security. I strongly support open source. I love implementing the principles in my work. And I am really excited to talk about sort of the work that we've been doing on a security side within IBM, because it's not all writing, you know, little toy languages for provable security. It's solving practical problems. So you'll hear a lot about that from me later.
Thank you, Sage. So I think, this being the SDS dev room, we're going to spare you the introduction to Ceph and the introduction to Rook. But they're awesome. Let's just sum it up as that. So let's start with security. So security practices harden a specific point of the infrastructure. Cherry picking practices without a model of the threat and the attacker is not a viable strategy. The joke usually goes that to make a computer secure, you cover it in concrete, drop it at the bottom of the ocean, and all that. But that's not a very useful computer. If you want to protect from all possible threats, you get a machine that is not very helpful in solving any of your problems. So what you do is that you define security in the context of your application and your users. Who are your adversaries? Who is most likely to attack you? And you prioritize that. Yes, there are some theories of security that say patch everything, protect from everything. But the reality is, if you don't pick your priorities, then you have no priorities. If you are trying to do everything, you're doing nothing. So some of these actors want to crypto-lock you and hold you for ransom. Others are just happy to delete your data and cause a disruption. These are very different threats. Script kiddies, who knows what they're up to? Just some excitement. Organized crime wants money back. So you profile your adversary, and you define what your threat model looks like. And then you start hardening for that threat model. So let's dive right in. The public security zone, let's start from the network. The public security zone in a Ceph network is an entirely untrusted area of the cloud. It could be the internet as a whole, or just networks external to your cluster you have no authority over. Data transmissions crossing this zone should make use of encryption. Note that the public zone, as I just defined it, does not include the storage cluster front end, the ceph public underscore network, which defines the storage front end and properly belongs in the storage access zone. So don't confuse the two. The ceph client zone refers to networks accessing ceph clients like the object gateway, the ceph file system, or block storage. Ceph clients are not always excluded from the public security zone. For instance, it is possible to expose the object gateways, S3 or Swift interfaces in the public security zone. Next, the storage access zone is instead an internal network providing ceph clients with access to the storage network itself. Finally, the cluster zone refers to the most internal network, providing storage nodes with connectivity for application, heartbeat, backfill, recovery, and all that. This zone includes the ceph cluster's backend network, called the clustered network in ceph. Operators often run clear text traffic in the cluster zone, relying on the physical separation or VLAN segregation of the network from other traffic. This would not be a valid choice, going back to the previous point, if your threat model includes privileged adversarial insiders. But it's perfectly fine if you're dealing with script kiddies. So again, threat profile. These four zones are separately mapped and combined depending on the use case and threat model on your actual physical and VLAN network. Components spanning the boundary of two security zones with different trustor authentication requirements must be carefully configured. These are natural weak points. Maybe they're not natural weak points, but they are natural targets in network architecture and should be always configured to meet the requirements of the highest trust level of the two zones or the two or three zones connected. In many cases, the security controls should be a primary concern due to the likelihood of probing for misconfiguration. Operators should consider exceeding zone requirements at integration points, which for a storage product is usually easier to accomplish than it would be for something more generic like an operating system. For example, the cluster security zone can be isolated from other zones easily because there is no reason for it to connect to other zones. Conversely, an object gateway in the client security zone will need access to the cluster security zone's monitors, 6789, OSDs, on 6800 all the way to however many OSDs you have, and will likely expose its S3 API to the public security zone, ports 80 and 443. I think that's right. There we go. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. So many people might be curious. We moved to IBM about a year ago. What's it like to move companies as an open source product? And the security of a product, we worry a lot about that. We're going to discuss that, of course, but how do we support it in a realistic way within industry? We can obviously find, we can make a fork of an open source product that's no longer supported, but do you really want to be in charge of maintaining that, updating all of its dependencies? Not necessarily. So I'll be discussing some aspects of IBM product security, how that's been going in practice and in theory, and I'll discuss some of our accomplishments and what we're planning going forward. So in terms of product security, we follow a secure development lifecycle with the goal of reducing risk and improving security for ceph and rook. We suggest improvements, we pen test, we manifest all of our dependencies, we review vulnerabilities, we track weaknesses, we review them and any exploits, we're approving all of our errata releases, making sure all the details are correct so that anybody, customer or not, can look and say, okay, what does this release fix? And as a result, we've been trying to modify this to work within the within a different model from Red Hat to IBM. And one thing that we've done is we've manifested and documented all of our dependencies. That's a challenge. I'm not sure if I can officially call it an SBOM. That would be a legal question, but getting there was a challenge. There are thousands and thousands of dependencies, things like that. We've also automated things like security scanning. Customers want clean scans, and this is true also in open source. We get emails on the security list saying, hey, Mend found 200 vulnerabilities. 80% of them are false positives. Half those CVEs have been rejected, but what are you going to do to fix it? So we're working to reduce even our lowest risk vulnerabilities, as long as it's actually a vulnerability. We're onboarded fully with IBM pCert, and we're fixing all of our prior vulnerabilities, no matter how low risk. That might seem silly, but it's a common compliance request. And in theory, somebody could find an exploit for even a very low CVE, and then it suddenly is no longer such a low-risk CVE. Suddenly it's actually an implemented one. And we're also trying to make our lives easier for the programming team and my work easier as well by automating all, most of our dependencies. We'll see how realistic it is to do all, but most is definitely true. This can oftentimes break builds though, because sometimes the code might have been refactored, details might change. It's not just as simple as update this number. So we're building that into our release cycle, and we're starting by prioritizing libraries and dependencies with many CVEs per release, which thankfully they're finding the CVEs, but you know, we want to start with the known ones first. So we'll be doing that. We're continuing to do our work of reviewing existing vulnerabilities, regular security updates, and just improving our code security preemptively. We've gotten a lot of upstream engagement since moving to IBM. People emailing the Ceph security list, multiple people with hundreds of vulnerabilities, lots of individual people emailing it with one or two that we investigate, and we're assigning CVEs. We're doing just a lot more there. And we've been implementing more changes based on customer and upstream requests, such as an update to the OS that the containers are running on. So we're eventually, in addition to all this, going to be following IBM standards to fix our vulnerabilities and ensure compliance. Currently, we're fixing all of the backlog of very low-risk bugs and vulnerabilities that we had, and we aim to be fully within IBM SLA and requirements by end of 2024. That should just give you an idea of how secure upstream stuff is going to be, because again, these are getting ported between Red Hat, upstream, and IBM. So how are we going to do this given that we have a very small security team and a slightly larger but still very small build team? The answer is automation. A lot of this work has historically been very manual, very in-depth, and you know, that's just not realistic when we're talking about the number of vulnerabilities, the number of people involved, and the product. By tracking dependencies, we're finding hundreds of things that we might not have even known about a while ago because we're like, oh, well, it doesn't really matter. It's just used in the build process. Actually, it does matter. So we're trying to write our own internal software for a lot of this work. We're trying to figure out how to open source it so you aren't just like, this is some random IBM specific website that you have to log on to their VPN to get our container and this code makes no sense. No, we want it to actually be available. And that's a challenge, but it's one that we are investigating and our commitment remains open source. So where we're able to open source any of this internal software, it will be open sourced. If it is incredibly specific, it may not be very useful if it's public, but anything useful we want to share with industry. And we're also sharing that within IBM. For example, one software that we wrote is to find all of our dependencies for our licensing needs. We're working on sharing this ethos of open source within our company of, hey, take this software, you might licensing team, you're spending days filling out spreadsheets. this is something that by sharing and improving on, your work is easier. So we're sharing this open source ethos there. We've also, in terms of automation, we've automated most of our compliance scans via Jenkins and our build pipeline, reducing the work of incident response from a multi-person team to something that can be done by one person as part of their job. And we're documenting all the core parts of the role, trying to define it, and trying to define what a security process looks like. Similar to how we did a secure software lifecycle at Red Hat, we're trying to define now, what does this job look like? What does the documentation look like? And again, if anything is able to be open sourced or is of use to industry, we definitely want to share it. In terms of other new work, again, fixing all CVE fixes, they'll be ported. New collaboration produces many new challenges, but it's overall going really well. Some things that we've done, we've worked to improve the call home functionality and security for IBM support by applying open source principles. If a vulnerability is there, customer smells it, people will see it. Visible bugs are good. When we know a bug, we can fix it. So we're working on using Ceph also as a backend for AI. We're happy to talk more, reach out to us, collaborate with us. What do you want to see with our collaboration with IBM? Feel free to discuss with us. And I also want to briefly discuss some of our new cryptography work. So we've been working with IBM research here a bit. We've been talking with them about confidential and quantum computing. Now, those are two separate things. In terms of confidential computing, many of you may be aware of what that is. It uses a trusted computing module, so you don't necessarily have to trust the server that Ceph is running on. You just have to trust the TCM within it. We're talking with IBM Research about how would this best fit in with Ceph. If it's viable, we'll be implementing it. With quantum computing, this is a priority for IBM, and they want to make a lot more software quantum safe, for example. So one thing that we're doing there is we're documenting all places where we use cryptography, determining if it's quantum safer because they're, you know, the quantum safe requirements are coming out this year, as are the libraries. So we're seeing, are we using public key encryption? Are we using symmetric encryption, asymmetric encryption? Where exactly are we using it? And where can we plug and play in these open source quantum safe cryptography libraries as they become available? So those are some of our goals and things that we're working on collaborating with them with. These are not yet in Ceph releases, but this is sort of a roadmap to the future of collaboration with IBM. And moving on to talk a little bit more about how Ceph currently does encryption and key management. Currently, what we do is we encrypt our data at rest. We have a choice, but most people choose to encrypt their data at rest using the Linux Unified Key Setup, aka Lux. All the data, metadata of a Ceph storage cluster can be secured using a variety of DMcrypt configurations. Almost all of our customers choose to do that. We implement security best practices by locating our mons on a separate host from the OSDs. That ensures anti-affinity of the keys in the data that they encrypt. This means that a driver host is physically separated from its decryption keys, which increases security and is just generally a best practice. Our object store gateway has some additional capabilities, including encryption at ingestion time, the use of per user keys, key rotation using tools like Vault. We support AWS, SSE, KeyMS, and others. We have Department of Defense ciphers certified under FIPS 140-2 as supplied by RHEL and appropriate versions. And for encryption in transit, we have network communication that can be secured by turning on the Ceph protocol encryption in Messenger version 2.1. We do allow clear text as a backup, but it isn't our only option. You can definitely certify your encryption in transit or use encryption in transit as well. And we also have the protocols where the Ceph protocol is physically or logically isolated, but if you, again, want more security, Messenger version 2.
So the backend protocols are not encrypted by default, but you absolutely can. And it gives it just a teeny little bit of latency. It doesn't really impact the performance that much, especially when CPU overhead is accounted for. Looking at more specific protocols for encryption in transit, S3 is usually secured between the RGW and the S3 client with TLS, port 443. You can also support plain HTTP on port 80, depending on the nature of your data and if you want it to be secured or not. We have a special case with our TLS termination at HA proxy, and the link between HA proxy and RGW is in clear text, so it has to be located within the appropriate security zone. But as we saw earlier, the security zones are a great feature of Ceph and Rook, so that makes it easier. And of course, with your network, you want to follow your best practices, such as firewalling individual nodes. You only want to expose a cleared list of ports. But assuming that you're doing that, that really covers a lot of our encryption in transit. And let's talk a little bit now about Rook specific and not just Ceph. So Rook can use custom resource definitions to encode many of these settings. We can configure our trust certificates for our RGW web server. Rook supports at-rest data encryption, as discussed earlier. And again, we have in-flight Ceph protocol encryption as of 1.9. Kubernetes user permission system also applies to the persistent volumes here. Permissions, quotas, all that comes from Kubernetes. Nothing Rook needs to do here. And Rook also supports a key management software in the CSI driver, allowing individual volumes to be encrypted with their own key. This really limits the scope per key. Again, security best practices. So we can follow those, like key rotation, revocation, limiting scope from each key. This really limits the scope of our unencrypted traffic, and it also limits the scope of each key. And going on to the control plane, as popularized by Ansible, SSH is used by Cephadmin, Cephansible, and other deployment day one tools to provide a secure command line path for installation and upgrade operations as part of host management. We do this so that the dashboard is usually, unless you configure it specifically, is not exposed to the world. People can't even see our Grafana dashboard. It's great. And also, although we don't want our dashboard to be exposed to the world, it needs to be reachable by the operator's workstation to be of use. So that's our control plane here, and we're doing that with SSH and how we install Ceph by default. The manager supports the whole infrastructure. It needs to be reachable on the storage access zone, so we use SSH for this. And you can see some of our details, such as our port ranges and details like that. Of course, the operator can modify this to have it suit your local threat model, but by default, we just try to make it as secure by default so people don't have to think too much about it. And with identity and access, Ceph's use of shared secret keys protects clusters from man-in-the-middle attacks by default. A good practice here is to grant key ring read and write permissions only for the current user and root. Limit your client admin user to be restricted to root only. You don't want all users to be root as per security best practices. And similarly with RGW, we want to treat the administrator's key and secret with appropriate respect, reduce your number of administrative users, and to do so, we support AWS S3, the equivalent model for OpenStack, and the equivalent model for OpenStack Swift. Again, that helps your keys and secrets remain secure by using these external software for your key management. Your RGW user data is stored within Ceph pools. These are secured, previously discussed, with data at rest. We also, in terms of keys, we can couple with OIDC providers such as KeyCloak, and those can be backed with your organization's identity provider for an even more granular role or attribute access, depending on the needs for your system and your threat model. So for identity and access, we also support LDAP and Active Directory users. We recommend secure LDAP, and we support OpenStack Keystone to authenticate object gateway users in OpenStack clouds. And for auditing, which is another important part of security, we of course support auditing. Operator actions against a cluster are logged. You need to periodically remove your logs, and you can aggregate them to your log management system where it's appropriate. Here's an example of what that might look like. You can see where they're stored. We can see this example here. And you know, an action might start on one node, it might propagate to others, and we're still logging everything. So I'm going to turn it over to Federico for the end. And here is data retention.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All righty. Let's see if we can get it through to the end. So, once data is deleted, it generally cannot be recovered for practical use. But, like with everything, there are exceptions. RBD has a new facility called the Trash Bin that makes use of spare capacity to preserve deleted images dynamically until the space is needed, until a certain number of days has elapsed. You can turn this on or off, but obviously this affects user data retention. Similarly, in RGW, RGW is an implementation of the S3 protocol in most use cases. S3 is versioned, so your data is versioned there unless you configure pools to be not versioned. So if you're storing user data in RGW, you need to watch that your configurations are, that your pool configurations are versioned according to the data retention that you want for that data. Otherwise, obviously the administrator can purge the versioning of RGW buckets, but that's one more thing that you have to account for to ensure compliance. Then there is explicit secure deletion. That's the other thing that we usually get asked about. The data is still on the clusters on the disk. And like in most storage systems, you cannot just go and say, I'm trying to overwrite everything to sanitize that. It won't even work on a standard SSD these days, at least not reliably, which is what you care about. Distributed network system, obviously it's not going to work. So the solution there is doing the right thing from the beginning. Implement at rest encryption. When you want to sanitize your media, you forget the encryption key and you're done. Very easy, very simple. Also, this has other advantages. You may want to sanitize your media typically because you have to return them under an RMA policy to have a warranty replacement. If you try to replace a drive that's been shredded, shot with a shotgun, or done all sort of untoward things to physically destroy it, most likely your warranty provider will not send you a new drive for it. So, again, using encryption is the right strategy here. Also, the majority of drives today does this on hardware for you, so you don't even need to manage. Set up an encryption key and set up a process to wipe it when the time comes. Then there is one more scenario, which is when you want to prevent the sanitizing of data, aka ransomware. So the most interesting bit in Ceph here is that RGW has a second factor authentication thing, and you can deploy this as a protection against ransomware attacks so that you essentially ask for a second factor for actions that a ransomware attack would use to re-encrypt your data. Hardening is relating to binaries. Hardening options are highly vendor dependent. These are Red Hat and IBM choices. Other binaries from other vendors may be different. Now, we ship with SE Linux on by default, and I don't think that surprises anybody, given that it's our local religion at Red Hat, and we carry it over to IBM. FIPS 142 ciphers, like Sage was saying earlier, are supported out of RHEL. So whenever RHEL is certified for FIPS 140 or 2 or now 3 with RHEL 9, those versions can be used with Ceph. There are older versions of RHEL than the current ones. There is a lag, as CISA needs to do the certification. But the option is there. We're not going to go into these hardening options, but you should be aware that they exist. And you should be knowing what your vendor uses. And some bookmarks for you to close. There are some interesting resources on Kubernetes from Acquia Security and from a book from O'Reilly called Hacking Kubernetes. It goes into very much into detail about storage in chapter 6. That's Michael Hausenblass' previous book. The Data Security and Hardening Guide comes from our product, and it's basically a written version of this talk. So if you want more, that's where you find it. Encrypted Secret Data at Rest is essentially another version of what's in Rani's talk, on Rani's article. And last one is to decrypt those binary flags that I was describing one slide ago. If you don't know what the GCC flags look like or what the kernel hardening options look like, there is a link there with the linker flags for GCC. There is also one, we ran out of space, there is a convenient page on the Ubuntu Teams, Ubuntu Server Project team page with all the kernel hardening options so you can find what they are. And then you look for your vendor what the setting for that specific option is. And that's it.